From Washington, the nation's capital, the Voice of America presents Issues in the News. The nation's top Washington correspondents offer their perspectives on the week's major stories.
Welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Barbara Slavin, Senior Fellow at the Atlantic Council and Washington correspondent for AllMonitor.com. Joining me on the show this week are Tim Mak, Congressional Correspondent for the Washington Examiner, and Stephen Collinson, White House Correspondent for Agence France-Presse. And here are the issues. Russia escalated pressure on Ukraine by threatening to cut off natural gas supplies unless the bankrupt country pays off its debts to Moscow. But there are also signs that pro-Russian provocateurs in eastern Ukraine are losing steam. And there are plans for new talks among Russia, Ukraine, the European Union, and the United States. The Obama administration continued efforts to resuscitate Israeli-Palestinian peace talks as all sides intensified a blame game and Israel suspended remitting tax revenues to the Palestinian Authority. Iran and the five permanent members of the UN Security Council plus Germany concluded another 2 days of talks in Vienna and made progress toward achieving a long-term nuclear accord. Meanwhile, the U.S. Congress sought to block Iran's choice for U.N. ambassador because he has links to the 1979-81 hostage crisis. And finally, cybersecurity specialists revealed that a superbug called Heartbleed has likely infected scores of internet sites, potentially compromising the passwords and personal information of millions of internet users. Let's start with Ukraine, which we've been talking about, I think, perpetually now for the last 3 or 4 months. Stephen, there were some positive signals, but there are also still 40,000 Russian troops along the border with Ukraine. How do you see the situation this week?
Right. Well, the administration is still in the position of warning Russia not to go any further, but still not really knowing exactly what Russia plans to do. The intent of Vladimir Putin is still a bit of a mystery in Washington. We saw this week that the administration is starting to make some moves which would suggest they're thinking of imposing more sanctions on Russia, going to target sectors of the Russian economy. The president spoke to German Chancellor Angela Merkel, and there was a clear message in the White House readout of that call that he was saying it may be time soon to go further. The administration has been accusing the Russians of using covert operatives to incite pro-Russian sentiment in eastern Ukraine. So there are two questions, really. Does Vladimir Putin intend to march some of those 40,000 troops across the border into Ukraine? And does he actually need to? He may be able to reach his goals of stopping a unified Ukraine becoming part of the wider EU, European, Western orbit simply by covert action inside Ukraine, as the same kind of thing we saw in Crimea, actually.
Yeah, Tim, there were some developments that were interesting, whereas in the past these kinds of tactics seem to work. They certainly work very well in Crimea. There seems to be a real backlash against these occupations, holding of hostages and so on in places like Donetsk, among Ukrainians, even in mm-hmm. eastern Ukraine. Mm-hmm. So I wonder if that string is played out now for Putin.
Yeah, the real calculus against Putin in eastern Ukraine has always been that if he were to invade, he would face much more fierce resistance than in Crimea and from the locals, and not just condemnations from the international communities. There might be armed revolt, something that he's not, I'm sure, looking forward to. Mm-hmm. But I think when we're talking about the American intelligence community and what they're trying to foresee and predict, this entire crisis has been in part precipitated because the American intelligence community could not figure out what Putin's next move would be. And they predicted that, in fact, Putin would not move into Crimea at all. In fact, days before Putin pulled the trigger, they predicted this would not happen. And so everything is in disarray as the American intelligence community fails time and time again to predict where Putin's going to go.
Yeah, but Stephen, as you pointed out, there are sanctions that could be imposed. My understanding is that we're on phase two sanctions now, and we could move to phase three. I also understand from some conversations with European diplomats that there are more entities and individuals that could be sanctioned under phase two before you go all the way to going after sectors like, of course, the Russian energy sector, which would be a huge blow to the Russian economy and could affect the global economy as well. So I guess there's a bit of gamesmanship now going on where we want to signal to the Russians that more adverse consequences could follow. Meanwhile, Putin has a lot of levers that he can use to try to influence what happens in the drawing of a new constitution for Ukraine, in the May 25 presidential elections that are coming up. Do you think that Putin would be satisfied with a new Ukrainian government that is seen as sensitive to Moscow's concerns?
A good question. I think the interesting thing for me is that Putin is playing a very long game. He knows that he's potentially going to be in power much longer than this administration, any of the European leaders. I think it's clear after the last 2 months that Vladimir Putin has a much different view of what's in Russia's interests. And he may not just be acting in Russia's interests, quote-unquote. He's acting in his own political interests, the interest of his conception of the Russian state. So that's why it's so hard to predict. He seems to be taking actions which to the West seem, you know, counterintuitive and unwise, but from his perspective, they seem to make perfect sense.
Yeah. Tim, I'm also hearing that, I mean, Putin is rather isolated, that he surrounds himself with yes men. He doesn't like to hear contrary views, and there are real questions. I mean, apart from the phone calls that he's had with President Obama and perhaps Angela Merkel and others, you know, real questions about how attuned he is to the reality of the Western response to what has been going on in Ukraine. And maybe this is part of the problem for our intelligence community, that they are not able to penetrate this very small circle of a half a dozen or so former KGB allies and childhood judo partners and whatnot that have influence on Putin.
Well, if he's not attuned to the reaction that says of the Western community, it must mean that the Western community is not speaking loudly enough. That is, that the sanctions that have been imposed thus far have not affected him into his inner circle. I mean, that's a reflection of what he's feeling. And yeah, the intelligence community has had lots and lots of problems penetrating his inner circles, so much so that they spent tens of thousands of dollars, maybe hundreds of thousands of dollars, paying people in the Pentagon to read Putin's body language and then interpret what that might mean for what happens in the future. This is actually happening. They're spending money on body language interpreters to digest what may come next. This is how clueless we are about the man's motivation.
All right, well, tell me what it means if somebody has to take off his shirt constantly and show his chest in public. What does the CIA make of that?
You know, I'm not a professional body language interpreter, but I gotta say, that speaks more about insecurity than security. I think so.
I mean, whether from a male or female point of view, I don't know. Although I suppose he figures if he has it, he ought to flaunt it. But that's fascinating. That's a detail that I didn't know. Another aspect of this where the West can step up to the plate, but it's going to take a while, Stephen, is on the energy front. Ukraine and the Baltics are 100% reliant on Russian energy. There's talk of reversing some pipelines, of eventually the United States and others being able to provide liquefied natural gas to Europe, to Eastern Europe, even to Ukraine, to reduce the dependence on Russia. How realistic is that?
That's a long-term solution. The problem is we're in a short-term situation. Vladimir Putin could deeply disrupt the European energy market and the economy if he goes through with his threat to cut off Ukraine's supplies. A lot of the gas that Russia supplies to Europe goes through Ukraine, so it could be problematic in the short term. The US makes 2 points. It says that Europe has sufficient gas at least to get through the rest of this winter. This threat of cutting off gas supplies was much more acute, I think, a couple of months ago than it would be right now. But it's the summer is short in Eastern Europe, and it will be another issue in time to come. President Obama came back from Europe 2 weeks ago now, and his senior aides are saying privately that they're actually convinced that the Europeans are serious about diversifying their energy supplies and would go through with some more punitive sanctions. I think the proof of that is definitely in the pudding, and it seems to be a more advanced position than you get when you talk to certain European diplomats and other sources. So I think that remains to be proved just how firm is the steel in Europe on this issue.
Yeah, and it takes time to gin up things like shale and, right. And whatnot. And I believe, you know, Germany has already phased out its nuclear energy. So and there are a lot of questions about what Europe could do to make up for a lack of Russian energy at this point. Let's turn to the Middle East and the on-again, off-again Israeli-Palestinian talks. This week saw, last few days rather, saw a continuation of this tit-for-tat on the part of the Palestinians and the Israelis. The Palestinians, I think, have now joined the Geneva Conventions, which is an interesting thing to do when you don't really technically have a state, and a bunch of other UN-related organizations and conventions. The Israelis, once again, are saying they won't give the Palestinians their own tax revenues, which the Israelis collect. Where's this going?
I think in reality there are reasons to think that this is going to continue, albeit at a low level. We're going to see, as usual, more process and not much peace. There are solid reasons why neither the Israelis or the Palestinians want to be blamed for scuppering this U.S. effort. The Palestinians, there's a great deal of fatigue with the process, but they do need Western investment, which could be cut off in if they're blamed for scuppering the talks. The Israelis are concerned about this divestment and isolation movement. They don't want that to get further if they're blamed for scuppering the talks, so that's why you've seen this blame game. And this administration has invested a great deal of time, political energy, and effort in this process. It doesn't want to have the embarrassment of a massive foreign policy failure. So I think you might see these talks continue. You'll see steps on both sides to de-escalate by the end of the month. There's a deadline for continuing. But basically what we're going to have is talking and not really getting anywhere, because neither of the sides are in a political position to make the concessions that you need to move this to a conclusion.
Tim, I don't know if you watched the hearing where Secretary of State John Kerry was taunted by Senator John McCain, basically said that he was failing on three fronts related to the Middle East, on Israeli-Palestinian, on Syria, and even on Iran, which I thought was a little premature. We'll talk about that in a minute. Are these fair criticisms of John Kerry?
They may not be fair criticisms of John Kerry per se. I mean, you can't put the weight of these collapsing Israeli-Palestinian talks on John Kerry alone. But they are disappointments in the Obama administration that are legitimate. If you look at the Obama administration's red line on Syria and the thousands and thousands and thousands of deaths that have occurred since that red line was crossed, I think Senator John McCain has strong standing to say, you guys haven't done what you promised, you haven't done enough to stop the bloodshed in Syria. And there is a lot of frustration on the Hill, but not a lot of solutions as to what John Kerry could do differently. You see the collapsing Israeli-Palestinian talks, but there aren't very many suggestions from the Hill as to how this might actually continue.
Yeah. We'll have more in just a minute. First, a reminder that you're listening to Issues in the News, coming to you on the Voice of America in Washington. I'm your moderator, Barbara Slavin of AllMonitor.com. Joining me today are Stephen Collinson of Agence France-Presse and Tim Mack of the Washington Examiner. And this is a reminder that you can listen to Issues online as a podcast. Please visit our website at voanews.com. Stephen, this criticism coming from the Hill, is it really about substance? Is it more about scoring political points? How fair is it?
I would say that it's both about scoring political points and substance. I think there are some serious people up on Capitol Hill, thinking, for example, of Bob Corker, who's the top Republican on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, who are making serious critiques of the administration. There are others who are grandstanding, trying to score political points. Senator Ted Cruz was a prominent voice this week on the Iran issue. He's contemplating a presidential campaign. So, you know, it's the same as it always is with the Hill. There's substance mixed in with politics. It kind of gets to one of the discussion this week and Tim's point that there are no real solutions being offered.
Yeah.
Gets to one of the most interesting questions, I think, about this administration's foreign policy. And it's, I think it's fair to say, and even people in the administration will admit, that the Obama administration has struggled to impose U.S. power on the rest of the world in many cases. There are many boiling foreign policy crises to which there don't seem to be any clear solutions. And the question is, could another president, could a different foreign policy have made a difference? And I don't think it's very easy to answer that question right now. You can criticize the administration on Syria. You can criticize them for perhaps not following through as they might have on their sort of vaunted pivot to Asia. But would sort of talking more loudly and carrying a bigger stick, to paraphrase John McCain's criticism of John Kerry this week, using a Theodore Roosevelt quote, have made a big difference? I think it's a difficult question to answer.
Yeah, especially given that Obama came into office as the United States was trying to wind down two wars. Definitely if you watch the debate over minor airstrikes against Syria after the chemical weapons episode, you saw that there was a complete lack of appetite on the part of almost everyone in Congress, with very few exceptions, to actually go forward even with limited strikes. So it appears that Obama has sensed the popular mood and simply does not want to get entangled in more military confrontations. But diplomacy sometimes can be a hard sell because it's very slow moving. And Iran talks actually are going reasonably well. I've heard the theory expressed that it's good that we have Ukraine and all these other crises, because the Iran talks are almost under the radar most of the time, Tim. And yet another session in Vienna, the Iranian foreign minister, Javad Zarif, says that they're 60% of the way there. What's your impression of how these talks are going? Do you think they can actually reach an agreement by the end of July?
Well, Barbara, Ryan, everyone at this panel knows that you're the real expert on Iran here, so I'd be curious to hear your thoughts as well. I'm not sure what substantively we can say about the talks. I mean, you will know better than I will, but when they say that they're making progress, that seems like diplomat speak to me, that I don't really see progress happening. If there is progress, where's the result? That's not to say that the talks have been unsuccessful. It's just that when people come out to the mics and they say, we've made a lot of progress, we're 60% of the way there, that doesn't mean a whole lot to me.
Yeah, well, the way the talks have been described by, you know, an anonymous American is as a Rubik's Cube. So you have to solve all the parts of the puzzle. They all have to fit together. And, you know, 60% is sort of meaningless. Even 95% would be meaningless without solving all the parts. But they did say, Stephen, that they're going to start actually drafting the agreement in the next round of talks in May. And, of course, we have constant communication now between American and Iranian technical experts on, you know, how they are going to reconfigure the Iranian nuclear program. My understanding being that the Iranians are insisting on keeping all the facilities, all the buildings, but can modify what goes on inside those buildings to address proliferation concerns. The White House seems fairly optimistic, yeah, in its comments on the talks?
Yes, the White House, I think, is encouraged by the way it's going. I think what we're going to see mirrored throughout these talks, though, is if you're in favor of the idea of talking to Iran about its nuclear program and you believe there's a diplomatic solution, you're going to be optimistic. I think you're probably seeing the same thing mirrored in Iran. The people invested in the talks are optimistic, and they think progress is being made. Skeptics are always going to say that, well, this is false progress. We're not really addressing the big issues. And when the deal, if there is a deal, is finally agreed, people who are opposed to the whole idea of talking to Iran are saying, well, what did we get for this? We didn't get anything, and we are lifting sanctions on Iran. The president, as far back as last year, said that we're not going to get a perfect deal with Iran.
Right.
Essentially, what's going to happen is you're going to get a deal that will freeze Iran's nuclear program at a certain point, from the point where it could, you know, go ahead and manufacture a nuclear weapon. That's not going to be enough for Obama's critics on Capitol Hill. It's not going to be enough for the Israelis. But that's the deal that's on offer. And the interesting thing is going to be the argument after the deal. And it seems to me that the president at least is in the position of being able to sell this to the American people, of saying, this isn't a perfect deal, but it's the best we can get, and it obviates the need for us to go to war immediately to deal with this problem. So it's going to be a problem that's it's stopping the clock, but it's not. You can't take away the expertise once the Iranians have it.
Absolutely. There is, you know, no military solution, frankly, to this, because the Iranians could always reconstitute a program. And if you attack them, they'll have even more motivation. But we've seen, of course, that now the Congress has grudgingly gone along with the administration. President Obama threatened to veto any new nuclear-related sanctions against Iran, but they're always looking for ways in which to complicate American diplomacy with Iran, it seems. There's a new bill that puts more sanctions related to Hezbollah, the Lebanese military group, whereas Hezbollah is already sanctioned quite heavily, as far as I know. And then we have this flap over the UN ambassador that Iran has apparently nominated, Mr. Aboutalebi, who, when he was 21, 22 years old, apparently did some translation work for the hostage holders back 35 years ago. Tim, how do you interpret this whole controversy? Was Iran foolish to even consider naming him? Has Congress gone overboard? What do you think?
Well, to nominate him is to totally misread how the American Congress would react, obviously. There's such strong bipartisan support for preventing this man from becoming an ambassador at the UN that you have Senator Ted Cruz, a Tea Party conservative, teaming up with Senator Chuck Schumer, perhaps one of the most progressive Democrats in the Senate, and coming together along with dozens of their colleagues to support banning this guy from the United States. So, yeah, it's a total misreading, at least, of the United States and how they would react.
On the other hand, this gentleman is a reformist now, as many of the former revolutionaries of that time were. And people who do certain things when they're 20, 21, 22 have a tendency to evolve over time. Many of these folks went on to become the real leaders of the reform movement in Iran in the mid and late 1990s. So in a way, barring this guy is barring somebody who would have been a rather interesting interlocutor. I mean, one could almost have imagined, you know, a debate on Charlie Rose or something with a former hostage where you could have given this guy an opportunity to apologize or at least explain
Has he apologized?
I do not believe he has, but I know that some of the former hostage holders have. In fact, a man named Abbas Abdi, who was one of the ringleaders, did apologize to one of the former hostages, Barry Rosen, at a dinner they had in Paris about 15 years ago. And there have been other expressions. Mohammed Hatemi.
I do
Hatemi,
wonder if an apology
would make a difference. Yeah, Mohammed Hatemi, the former president, expressed regret for the way in which American feelings had been hurt by the hostage crisis, was the way he put it in an interview with CNN in 1997. But, you know, I think clearly, Stephen, if the U.S.-Iran relationship, bilateral relationship, is ever going to really progress, there's going to need to be some formal expression of regret, I think, on both sides for the harm we've done to each other. I mean, it's not just, you know, the U.S. Supported Saddam Hussein against Iran during the Iran-Iraq War that killed 250,000 young Iranians. Some might argue that was a more serious exercise of power than what happened during the hostage crisis.
Right, and this episode is yet again another example of how symbolically powerful the hostage crisis remains in U.S.-Iran politics. But the Iranians would turn around and say, well, our grievances are much more long-lasting. The CIA was involved in the Mossadegh era. So at some point, if there were to be a rapprochement between the U.S. and Iran, all of this would need to be worked through. I'm sure it could be diplomatically be worked through in a skillful kind of way. Right now, however, the administration has said these issues aren't really on the table. What the administration is concentrating on is the Iran nuclear deal. And, you know, we've seen how difficult it has been for the president to sell that in Congress. Imagine some kind of wider rapprochement, reopening embassies, a normalization of relations. I think that's probably something that's going to be the work of many years and probably a new administration before that can be done. But it definitely is a sort of a reminder that as people get caught up in the president's phone call with the Iranian president last year and the so-called progress of these talks, that this is a very intractable issue.
It is indeed. There are a lot of chips on a lot of shoulders and a lot of hurt feelings to be assuaged before we get to a better place with the Iranians. In the time we have remaining, Tim, can you perhaps, since you're the youngest person here and probably the most technologically savvy, explain a little bit about Heartbleed and whether we have to change all our passwords at once, whether it makes any difference, whether if we change our passwords that actually will be tipping off the criminals who lurk on the internet, or are we all doomed?
Don't change your passwords yet. So Heartbleed is a vulnerability in a secure encryption service that you and I and everyone who's listening uses when they go on their email accounts, when they go bank online, whatever else. When you go to a secure website, there's a little lock that shows up on the left side near the URL. And that shows that you're sending encrypted information back and forth between the computer. There's been a new vulnerability that shows up in which people can listen in on this encrypted information being sent back
and
forth.
So the lock is a lie.
The lock has some vulnerabilities. And it isn't clear whether these vulnerabilities have been used, but it's widely used across emails, by banks, by pretty much every form of social media, and people are now in the tech industry scrambling to implement a fix. Now, if you change your password before the fix is implemented, you are essentially showing your new password to whoever might be using
the vulnerability.
So you might
as well stick with your corrupted original password.
With your original password until you can verify that there's been the fix that's been put forward. In fact, in the last 24 hours, we've figured out that Heartbleed is much worse than we originally believed, that it affects not just websites, but servers as well, meaning people can hack into your personal home computers and not just the data you send through the internet. It's gotten quite worse.
Oh, my. It does go to show that you should never put anything on the internet, certainly that you don't expect the entire world to see, and that certainly goes for your emails. Any thoughts on this vulnerability?
I can't remember the passwords I have. I don't know whether to change anymore. It's the bane of my life. I always have to go through that process where you forgot password for everything.
Yeah, it's
a pain.
Well, hopefully, those who are listening to us on the web will have no problem listening, and their passwords have not been corrupted. That's all the time we have this week. Joining us today were Tim Mak, congressional correspondent for the Washington Examiner, and Stephen Collinson, White House correspondent for Agence France-Presse. This program was produced by Anya Zalewski, and our engineer was Bill Barber. I'm Barbara Slavin, senior fellow at the Atlantic Council and Washington correspondent for AlMonitor.com. Thanks for listening.
From Washington, the nation's capital, the Voice of America has brought you Issues in the News. You can email your questions or comments to our panelists. Send them to voanews@voanews.com. And to keep up with all the latest news, tune in the Voice of America on radio, television, or the World Wide Web. Join us next week at this time for Issues in the News.